Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, strict new air pollution regulations are proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency. Some say you'll die without them. Others say you'll go broke with them. Celebrate the environment with a living Christmas tree you can plant when the festivities are over. Rotting leaves make environmental scientists out of children. And in our Earth calendar, frozen frogs fight frigidity fantastically. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has announced proposed new air quality standards, which it proposes to put into effect after a 60-day public comment period. Michael Oppenheimer, chief scientist of the Environmental Defense Fund, describes what the new regulations are designed to accomplish.
They're designed to protect human health better than it's being protected right now. Air pollutants, particularly the components of smog, and there we point to a chemical called ozone and another one called particulates, are known to be detrimental to human health, particularly insofar as they affect human respiration, that is, the lungs, and indirectly our cardiovascular health.
EPA proposes to reduce permissible levels of ground-level ozone by a third and to reduce the size of particulates we are exposed to. Oppenheimer says most particulates result from chemical reactions caused by sulfur dioxide.
The major source of particulates is not the kind of coal dust image that you have in your head, but it is the conversion of one of the gaseous emissions, sulfur dioxide, into particles called sulfates, which are very small. They are about a hundredth the thickness of a human hair, and they can travel long distances in the atmosphere, and you breathe them, and they get deep into your lungs.
Oppenheimer says the major impact of the proposed regulations will be on consumers of fossil fuel, power plants, and automobiles. A storm of controversy has arisen over the proposals, as is reflected by my conversation with Debbie Sprentz from the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group, and Wayne Brow with Citizens for a Sound Economy, which represents an industry perspective. Wayne, let's start with you. The new rules, do they make any sense?
Well, I would say they don't make a lot of sense at this point, and I'd like to clarify, it's not just an industry perspective. What we're looking at is talking about changing the way everybody lives their lives. These rules could affect everything from carpooling requirements to what you can and do with a barbecue in your backyard. I mean, they're very expansive, and I think at this point, a bit premature to jump into something that could cost billions of dollars a year.
And Debbie, I assume that you see this somewhat differently.
Well, all of the science that's available points in the same direction, which is to say that the current standards for ozone and particle air pollution are not protective of public health. The studies that are available show that with current levels of air pollution, indeed levels below the current standards, tens of thousands of people are dying early because of exposure to air pollutants. We have hundreds of thousands of people sent to the hospital. These effects have high costs on all of us. It's interesting that the industry campaign to try to stop EPA from setting standards that protect public health focus on impacts on individuals. We have the American Automobile Manufacturers Association telling us we won't be able to have cookouts anymore. What they really mean is that they don't want to clean up their dirty diesel trucks and buses. And they're trying to stop this proposal by pretending that someone else is the problem, when in fact we know that sources like uncontrolled coal-fired power plants and steel mills and diesel trucks and buses have a long way to go before they're clean.
Now, Wayne, I think I heard you say that this really, among other things, is a cost issue, that huge costs are imposed with questionable benefit. Do you have a sense of what kind of costs you're concerned about?
I mean, for instance, one study looked at Chicago, and they to come into compliance in Chicago alone would cost anywhere from $2 to $7 billion a year. This is on top of the Clean Air Act, which is in place right now. We're spending about $15 to $20 billion a year. So we're spending a significant amount of money, and I think there are enough questions in the science at this point where there's a lot of correlations, but there's a lot that's you, once you start trying to slice it more finely, it gets very difficult to say what's causing what. And until you get to that point, I think imposing billions of dollars on ultimately consumers, because if a company does get new restrictions, the company is not going to pay it. It's going to lower the wages it pays its employees. It's going to pass the cost on to the consumers and what they pay
so,
the grocery store.
Wayne, just to clarify your position, from your perspective, if the science did show that the health effects were as Debbie claims they were, would you think it would then be justified to...
I think, in a sense, they're almost taking a medieval approach to the science here. You know, laws first and science later. I think if you do any policy, you have to start with good science, and you have to have the scientific debate aired publicly and get the input you need before you put in some draconian measures that you're not quite sure of what are you actually regulating. What do these little particles that we're trying to regulate look like?
So,
do
Debbie,
we know enough to do anything yet?
How good is the science?
Well, Peter, the only people questioning the science, in fact, are the industry associations that don't want to clean up their pollution. But every independent expert scientific panel that's looked at this matter has concluded that the ambient air quality standards are out of date. So I don't think it's a scientific debate here, frankly, because the consensus of international scientific opinion is that we need to tighten up on these standards. I think we have a political debate between those who are bearing the costs of this air pollution. The victims of air pollution are seniors, our kids, our families with heart and lung problems, and those that don't want to clean up their diesel buses and their coal-fired power plants.
Debbie Sprentz is from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Wayne Brow is from Citizens for a Sound Economy. The Environment Show has a new toll-free number. Call us at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Tell us what's on your mind, and let us know if you wish to join us on the air for a discussion of environmental issues. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. You can also reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or you can visit us via the Internet and hear the Environment Show anytime. You can also check out our interactive question of the week. That's at www.enn.com/envshow and click on Listen to the Environment Show. That's www.enn.com/envshow. If none of that works, try a carrier pigeon. At the holiday season, environmentalists fret about overconsumption and waste. But Greg Ward, president of Ward's Nursery and Garden Center in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, tells us you can have a live tree and plant it afterwards. He also says that even if you get a cut tree, you're promoting sustainable agriculture. The message is that having a Christmas tree is something everybody, even hardcore environmentalists, can feel good about. Greg, for folk who would like to have a living Christmas tree and live in northern climates, what do you recommend?
Well, I recommend spruce or fir or pine, and some or all of those are native to our area and so are easy to obtain at your local garden center or tree grower. However, the trees should be kept at room temperature, that means kept in the house for no more than 5 or 7 days so that they remain dormant, so that they do not wake up. The root ball, which is, or the container where the roots are kept, should be kept moist for that period of time. And then after Christmas, you would, in milder climates where the ground is still not frozen, you would plant the tree, dig a hole and plant it at that time. And in colder climates, such as we're in, the ground may be frozen at that point and not possible to plant. And so you would store the tree in a shady, cool place against the side of the garage, out of the wind, and wait until spring, hopefully being able to insulate the root ball or container with some kind of materials, mulches, leaves, etc.
Now, in southern areas where spruce may not be as common, are there other plants that you recommend?
Well, yes, there are. There are pines that grow in the south, and there are juniper that grow in the south. I actually took a moment to call Jenny from Cairo, Georgia, which is southern Georgia, and there they like to use upright junipers that come in containers, usually, as the Christmas tree.
Greg Ward is president of Ward's Nursery and Garden Center. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, environmental education teaches science and a lot more. A portrait of a muddy lake in Indiana. And in our Earth calendar, frigid winter temperatures freeze frogs solid and they survive. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Most children have a natural attraction to the environment. Some like to play in the mud. Others collect flowers. Today, environmental education programs use nature to teach children about science and other subjects. One of the most successful programs is called Eco Inquiry. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally visited a city school in Poughkeepsie, New York, which uses Eco Inquiry and has this report.
Educator Catherine Corey and a fifth grade class at Waring Academy, a public school in Poughkeepsie, get ready to go outside and retrieve their experiment. A week ago, they wrapped some leaves in window screening and buried them in the schoolyard. Corey buried an equal number of leaves in the yard of her farmhouse outside the city. They're going to see which set of leaves decompose faster. The school is in an urban neighborhood, and students speculate that the leaves will break down faster in the country. But an examination of the leaves doesn't offer immediate answers. Both sets look only slightly decayed, and one of the students, Deshaun, says the leaves will have to spend more time underground since the weather has turned cold.
The bushes are too cold for decomposers and microbes to come outside because it's too cold for them to come out. So they probably somewhere on and real deep in the ground, and they're not even where they probably just went right past. Like the worms, they probably just went right past the bag and just probably went sleep deeper underneath the ground.
Deshaun's counterparts mostly concur, but vigorously debate other points, such as whether the screen may have kept the worms away. Catherine Corey says she wants the students to debate and challenge each other. Inside the school laboratory, the debate continues. Which leaves are more decayed? What's decaying them? And are the research methods holding up?
Over here is real little tiny bite marks right here. And it looks like it has been decomposed, but then they probably left as it got colder.
So what do you think these little white marks are?
I don't know what it could be. Maybe it's a different type of, maybe it's scat. A different kind of microbe or something?
Or scat.
And I think that
maybe that's a type of fungus or something that might be on it.
That's what it's called.
It could be a fungus or a bacteria.
Studying leaves is part of a curriculum called Eco Inquiry, developed by Cass Hogan at the Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York. With eco-inquiry, students learn by asking questions and conducting scientific experiments. Right now, they're studying the decomposition process, and these fifth graders are thrilled that studying slimy critters and icky mold is considered schoolwork. Scat, a common scientific name for animal feces, is the favorite word of many kids, and they use it as often as they can. Catherine Corey says inquiry-based science education teaches kids how to acquire knowledge.
The inquiry process to teach science
is really what science is. What these kids are doing in their classroom and in this program is not that different from what real scientists are doing out in their own work. They collaborate with one another in setting up experiments. They have questions that they want to answer. They collect data. They analyze the data. They, you know, show their data to their peers and get feedback on that. You can't separate science, in my mind, from science inquiry.
But how does eco-inquiry match up against other science curriculums? Catherine Corey says in just 10 years, eco-inquiry has spread to over 3,000 schools and is now funded by the National Science Foundation. Nancy Silverman is the science teacher at Waring Academy. She says kids have fun learning about the environment around them.
And they like doing this. I mean, discovering for them is the best way for them to learn. They're discovering for themselves how the world works. And at this age, they also build an enthusiasm because these kinds of things are fun for them. They have ownership of this project, and they know where it's going and what they're looking for, and it becomes theirs, and that gives them some power too, because then they buy into it. They want to know.
The goal of eco-inquiry is not to conduct experiments where the outcomes are known, but to engage students in real scientific investigations. For instance, the experiment with the leaves may not yield anything conclusive. Leslie Williams is the teacher of the fifth grade class at Waring Academy. He says if that happens, that's fine. It will just encourage more discussion, debate, and intrigue.
Well, science is just not reading stuff out of a book and answering questions at the end. It's actually manipulating data, developing data, working with specimens, actually setting up the experiments. And we're doing a lot more of that. And it creates a discipline in the children as far as being able to keep good notes, being able to follow along prescribed steps. And it's also carrying over into other areas as well, into other subject areas, because now we start to see a lot more questioning. I hear a lot of children questioning other students about, well, why do you think that is? Can you explain that? Whereas before, it probably wouldn't have happened like that. Children would have kept their comments to themselves. So we're teaching them how to interact at a totally different level, and they're really eating that up.
The leaf experiment is now about a month old, and the results are still sketchy. Many students predicted that decomposition occurs at a faster rate in rural areas. For now, the debate continues. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We all have places which are special to us. They could be a city block or a place deep in the wilderness. Julia King lives on a lake in a small town in Indiana. She admits it's not the greatest lake in the world, but it's attracted folks like herself who yearn for a quiet waterfront home. Now, development may have reached a limit, and she wonders how many more people like her the land can support.
I live on a dirty, semi-man-made pond. Once, after a heavy rain, I stood on my rickety dock and counted 12 dead fish floating on the surface. Industrial and agricultural runoff wreak havoc with rivers and lakes here in northern Indiana. But brown and foul-smelling as the pond may be, the sun still dances over its ripples, and my canoe still glides across its murky water. That's enough to make the surrounding property desirable. My dirty little pond sparked a heated controversy at our town's small private college. Years ago, Goshen College set aside a retreat for students and faculty on wooded land at the water's edge. An old cabin houses the occasional alumni reunion or intimate wedding. But an incoming president requested a bigger home, and the Board of Overseers decided to build on the retreat land. That angered local students, who staged an actual protest in Goshen, Indiana, where we're usually very polite. They worried that cutting down towering oaks and maples just yards from their cabin would also cut into their serenity. They worried that ducks and geese would no longer nest in the tall grass beside the water. I'm thinking they don't know about the dead fish. But that's probably irrelevant. They were reacting to Americans' schizophrenic love affair with nature. They know it's the very trees to be cut that made the site appealing. They know that we flock to waterways and love them from blue to brown. They know we move into cozy wooded neighborhoods and then pull out the power saws to make room for our garages. It makes me thankful for those people who jam themselves into high-rise apartments with honking cars a million floors below. They're not creeping into forests and displacing helpless deer and bunny rabbits. They're not flushing illegal septic systems into streams and lakes. It's those of us with a need for wide open spaces and a private showing of nature's matinee that are doing most of the harm. We're the ones that drive too far to dinner in the grocery store, while city dwellers hop on a subway, or better yet, walk. Sure, they pile on top of one another without apology like a bushel of crabs, but they keep their collective noise and urban filth to themselves. So what am I going to do about this? Am I going to fling my canoe on my car and head for the big lights? Am I going to walk away from my tranquil surroundings to stave off the horrors of development? No. But thanks to some passionate students, that's just what the new college president will do. Now, if she just takes some of my neighbors.
Julia King is a freelance writer in Goshen, Indiana. She comes to us by way of Great Lakes Radio Consortium. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. If you think you have it bad in the winter, wait till you hear about the wood frog. From Virginia to the Arctic Circle, wood frogs are freezing solid. Richard Lee is a professor in the zoology department at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He says most amphibians survive the winter by burying themselves underwater, but the wood frog spends the winter on land and freezes when it gets cold.
In this environment, they will experience temperatures below freezing. Fahrenheit degrees, it may go down to 26, 28 degrees Fahrenheit. And when the temperature drops down to about 30 degrees Fahrenheit, ice begins to form within their bodies. This freezing process occurs relatively slowly. The ice continues to accumulate, and eventually they become solidly frozen. Something on the order of 65 to 70% of their body water as ice.
Only a few species of frogs and some species of box turtle can freeze like the wood frog. Once the temperatures dip below freezing, they produce 1 to 200 times their normal amount of glucose. The same percentage in any other animal would be lethal. Lee says they also dehydrate their vital organs.
As they begin to freeze, they move water out of their heart, out of their kidney, out of their brains, into spaces within the body, within the abdominal cavity, for example, you'll see large chunks of ice beginning to form. And by dehydrating the various organs throughout the body, we believe it decreases the chance there will be mechanical damage if the water had remained there and ice had formed within those organs.
The freezing frogs have attracted the attention of medical doctors who are interested in applying the frog method to human organs. Currently, human organs have only a few hours to be transplanted before they deteriorate. But wood frogs can freeze and thaw numerous times throughout the winter. Preserving human organs would mean thousands more people each year could receive life-saving transplant operations. But the process is still a mystery. Professor Lee says the frogs survive because they have adapted to the sensitive microclimate, which exists just below the surface.
The fact that they are here and they're common suggests that this adaptation protects them very well. The critical thing to recognize here is that when you're beneath the leaf litter and beneath snow, you're in a very buffered environment. In fact, if you were to go out and monitor temperatures at the base of a snowpack that's accumulated on the ground, the temperatures very rarely drop much below 0 degrees centigrade.
When the temperature drops and the winds howl, unfortunately, we can't fight the chill by just crawling under a rock somewhere and freezing like the wood frog. The trouble is that antifreeze for humans, which is distilled and comes in both fifth and pint-sized bottles, doesn't work very well either. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 363. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.